It's Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds, KOW's executive producer for community engagement, joined by Erica C. Barnett, C is for crank, Jonathan Martin, editorialist at the Seattle Times, Jossie Ross, local lawyer and activist who works with Native American youth. Bill Radke's away this weekend. Welcome. Now, you may not have heard of Seattle 2035. It's a 20-year plan to accommodate more than 100,000 new residents. The mayor's office is going to pass it on to the Seattle City Council for consideration and passage later this year. Some of you might be thinking, zoning, urban planning, I feel a coma coming on. Erica, why should people be paying attention to Seattle 2035?
Well, as the name implies, it is a planning document that's going to shape our city for the next 20 years. For that reason alone, it's worth paying attention to. The biggest change that's happening in the plan is that the urban villages, it sort of doubles down on what's known as the urban village strategy, which is where you put most development kind of around commercial cores in neighborhoods.
The University District, Ballard,
exactly.
Are examples of that.
Mm-hmm. And it's doubling down on that policy, but also expanding the urban villages a little bit to reflect the fact that we now have access to transit in more of the city. So those sort of transit accessible areas are going to become more urban, less single family. And so those areas are going to sort of inch out a little bit into what are now single family areas in an effort to, you know, both reflect that new transit access, but also to protect the single family areas that are not going to be, you know, changed by this plan.
Well, I suppose I don't live in an urban center. I don't even live near one. I'm pretty far away. Why should I care?
Well, I mean, your neighborhood is, you know, possibly, most likely about to become more vibrant. I live in a pretty single family area myself now. But I live near an urban village, and I live near a development at 23rd and Jackson that's going to be huge. So for me, living in a single family neighborhood, I get excited when I see that there are things happening near me, because then, you know, I don't drive a car, but if I did, I would be excited that I don't have to drive so far to get to, you know, to the movie theater, to shops, to services. So if you live in a single family neighborhood, I think this is a positive thing for you. And also, you know, people should know, because I know people are always worried about their single family neighborhoods being decimated by development or whatever, that this does protect, quote unquote, most of the land that is currently zoned single family. Now, I personally don't think it goes far enough to develop those areas, but we can get to that later.
We're talking about Seattle 2035, a 20-year plan to accommodate new residents. Jonathan Martin, why do you think people should care about this?
Well, I'm going to take issue with something Erica said, that actually it protects most of the single-family zones. It actually says specifically in the plan that it's going to allow more types of development within the single-family zones, and specifically says that will allow a permit for variations from, I'm in quote here, variations from established standards for planned large developments in single-family areas. So if you remember back last year when the HALA plan came
out. That's the housing affordability plan.
Yeah. Yeah, this is Mayor Murray's big housing affordability plan, that he initially proposed serious changes to single family zone. And all it took was a single column by Danny Westney of my paper, and people backed Murray backed the hell out of there with
immediately. A lot of people living in single family neighborhoods saying to themselves, "Oh my goodness, this is going to mean a lot of development here." So he backed off on it.
The second thing that I think people should pay attention to is that right now there's a very interesting power structure around development in City Hall, and the urbanist advocates have linked arms with the environmental and biking advocates and the developers. And this power structure right now is extremely strong and very pervasive.
Encouraging density.
And it's interesting because you have the philosophical forces like the urbanist community that are basically enabling developers to make tons of money. And it creeps me out a little bit, frankly.
Yeah. Well, I want to hear what Jossie has to say about this, but how do you add 100,000 new residents to the city without having more density, Jonathan? I mean, isn't this a fait accompli?
Well, I think what Erica talked about, the urban villages strategy, makes a ton of sense. And I think that it has been very successful at channeling growth into these neighborhood cores that provide a lot of amenities to neighborhoods.
Yeah.
So that's a good strategy. I would also point out that there's existing zoning capacity in the city for the predicted amount of growth.
Mm-hmm.
So this is adding zoning capacity beyond what we need to accommodate the growth.
In order to build affordable housing, right. We wouldn't have that affordable housing without that additional zoning capacity. Just existing zoning capacity being there doesn't mean it gets developed.
Jesse, you don't live in Seattle. You do vote in Seattle. Do you think people outside Seattle should care about the Seattle 2035 plan? It is going to involve a lot of new residents here. Does it affect people outside the city?
I think specifically people of color, brown folks, should be very concerned about the 20-year plan. I look at the plan. It's interesting, like, you know, the Force Awakens, right? The new Star Wars movies. And it was interesting that one of the lead characters was black, because one of the critiques of the old series was that there's no black people in the future. And it seems like these 20-year plans, there's a lip service that's given to racial equity, right? That we're going to monitor. And, you know, for racial disparities.
That's supposed to be one of the core values of
that's right.
Plan.
Exactly. But there's nothing in my estimation that's given as specific goals, specific deliverables regarding what does that mean? In what I mean by that is that we've already seen the momentum of mediocrity,
sure,
regarding Seattle's plans of how brown skin folks are going to be excluded from the city.
How would you set a goal? I mean, what would a goal look like? What would it be a number?
I think it would be regarding concepts. So there's euphemisms that are being used, you know, regarding affordable housing and, you know, density. So that's supposed to be a panacea, something that is a balm.
To solve everything.
To solve everything, yeah, regarding diversity. And that's simply not true, because the way they're lined up right now, those luxury apartments that are going to have more density,
yeah,
those are entirely unreachable to a good portion of people who otherwise might want to live there.
Okay, this is kind of the broad picture, some of the big issues with Seattle 2035, but I wanted to get back to you, Erica, because you focus on a real place where this is happening, and it has to do with this idea of backyard living spaces, about building accessory places in a backyard where someone, homeowner, could maybe rent it out to someone, could maybe even make it into an Airbnb. And this is one specific issue having to do with the future plan. What's going on with that?
Well, this touches on that, but I want to correct one thing that Jonathan said about Danny Westneat's column, that it called on about serious changes to single family zones. It was to allow duplexes, triplexes, and some stacked flats. So we're
okay.
Talking about, like, minor
change. The change of a single family zone if it's not a single family zone?
It would still be. Well, we can talk. I mean, I don't think we should have single family zones as they're currently constructed.
Was it serious,
because I think
wasn't
we
it?
Should allow duplexes and things like,
right,
backyard cottages. And that does change single family zoning somewhat to allow, again, a homeowner to stay in their home, to rent out their garage. Now, what's happening, I think, because of, you know, the sort of the chorus of backlash when Danny's column came out, what's happened at neighborhood meetings is the city council and the mayor are both backing down on changes to the 60% of Seattle land that's zoned single family. And so it's going to become harder than was originally planned to build a backyard cottage, to put a mother-in-law apartment inside your basement. The new requirement, or the new proposal, would require the owner to live there for a year. And
what's wrong with that? Why not require the owner who's building the backyard cottage to at least stay in the home for a year?
Well, I think that it represents an attitude toward renters, that renters are inherently bad neighbors, that if that homeowner moved away and rented out both of those two units, and again, this is not a massive amount of density, we're talking about allowing one more person who can, you know, maybe not afford to buy a home to live there. There's a lot of that attitude in the idea that two people renting means bad neighbors. If you have the landlord there monitoring the renter, they'll somehow be a better neighbor than otherwise.
Well, hopefully we've gotten you interested in Seattle 2035. You can go to the website with the same name and read much more detail on it. It's something you really should find out more about. This is the Week in Review. Erica C. Barnett, writer at C is for Crank. Jonathan Martin, editorialist at the Seattle Times. Attorney Jesse Ross. I'm Ross Reynolds, KUOW executive producer for community engagement. In for Bill Radke. Got thoughts? Tweet us at hashtag KUOWWIR. Bill Radke's away. I'm Ross Reynolds, KUOW executive producer for community engagement. It's Week in Review. We're chewing over the stories with Erica C. Barnett, at C is for Crank, Jonathan Martin. You can read his editorials at the Seattle Times and attorney Jassy Ross. March 19th, Sound Transit opened new light rail stations at Capitol Hill and Husky Stadium. They threw a huge party. They were partying up, all right. The Seattle Times reports the price tag, more than $858,000. Now, was it money well spent, or could that money have been better spent on other things, like, say, transit? Jonathan Martin, what do you have to say?
Well, my daughter and I went to the opening because I think a lot of folks who haven't had access to the transit north of the Ship Canal were interested in seeing what it looks like, and had a great time. We went and my daughter and I biked over and went and took the train down, had sushi in Pioneer Square. I don't know why I needed a lanyard and a bag and $600,000 worth of crowd control to do that. This is the fundamental problem with transit agencies that feel like they need to market this as with all these bells and whistles. What they need to do is provide a good, reliable, affordable service to move people around. Roger Rogoff, the new Sound Transit CEO, came into our editorial board recently and made exactly that point. He was talking about the lack of Wi-Fi on trains. He said, if we're going to get people out of their cars, which is what we want to do, and I agree with, then we need to make this an attractive service. And having all these bells and whistles and blowing $800,000 does just the opposite.
Yeah, well, was it blowing it? That's the question. Maggie Femia, a former King County Council member, Puget Sound Regional Council Transportation Policy Board member, and skeptic about Sound Transit, she told the Times regarding this $858,000 party, supposedly the riders are there. That's why they built these stations. That's why they build light rail. So do you actually have to throw a big party to get them to show up? It doesn't make sense, end quote. That was her take on it. Jassy, what do you think about the party?
I agree with both her and Jonathan. I think that ultimately, I'm sure people noticed that there was massive construction going on for the past couple of years. I don't think there was any doubt that something was happening. And so the fact that you need to have this level of excuse for, you know, pageantry, that it amounts to excess. It's not a small amount of money. And so, you know, it's like having a big party for the electric company. It's a utility ultimately, right? You want to have the emphasis and the cost to be ingratiated into the service itself. And this, it just strikes me as, I don't particularly have strong feelings about it. I don't think it's the worst thing in the world, but I think it's stupid. I think it's a waste of money that ultimately, as taxpayers, everybody should question.
And what it does, it corrodes the, it will corrode the support for the ballot initiative in the fall.
Erica, are you pro-party?
Well, let's be real here. We're not talking about an $858,000 party. I mean, that's a typical overwrought Seattle Times headline that was completely misleading and inaccurate.
What's wrong about it?
I mean, well, Mike Lindblom's story accurately described what this $858,000 or whatever paid for, which was crowd control. And I don't know. I'm not sure how you provide reliable transit service on the first day of a major light rail system opening without providing any crowd control.
And so you're saying they would have spent that money anyway.
Yeah.
So and you shouldn't call that a party.
Let's not call this a party. I mean, okay. And Frank, I mean, when I saw that headline, I was like, wow, I was at that party. That cost that much. And I couldn't figure out what they spent it on. But, you know, but the fact is they've made back the money in ridership that's been far over projections. And I would disagree that, you know, people just see the hole in the ground and they're like, I'm going to go ride that transit service. I think you do need marketing to tell people, here's what it's going to do for you. Here's how it's going to improve your life. And here's why you should be riding this. And in fact, it has paid off.
Well, the very accurate Seattle Times headline also said that the opening of the 520 bridge, that the WASDOT guy, Washington State Department of Transportation, actually got a sponsorship from Delta Airlines.
That's true. They threw a party, but they also got some private money to pay for
and
it.
We're just talking about the point here is about sort of the message this sends to the voters about the fiscal discipline
and
of this agency.
That's exactly what I want to get to. I mean, regardless of what you think about the party, Sound Transit is spending eye-watering amounts of money to build this transit system. There are clearly a lot of politicians and businesses involved in that project with a self-interest in saying this money is being well spent, whether it's on the party or anything. How does the average taxpayer know whether it's true or not? Erica?
Know whether it's true that
whether
the money is being well spent?
Yes.
Well, so far, Sound Transit has not gone over budget. So, I mean, without digging into the details of their particular budget line items, I mean, you can see that they're providing reliable service on time and sometimes ahead of time and on budget and sometimes under budget. So I think that is enough to say, you know, this is actually a system that's worked. And it's, you know, and Sound Transit was in a lot of financial trouble, remember, before, around 2001,
that's true.
Too.
It's gotten out from under that.
And it's gotten out from under it.
But Jassy, just the fact that they're not running over budget, does that mean we should believe that all these we're spending money well and we should spend even more money when we're asked to fund Sound Transit 3 in the fall?
No. I mean, fiscal responsibility means that if there's money saved, good. That's a positive thing. It doesn't mean we have to make it up with a big line item expense. And I think we should absolutely question. We have an obligation to question every single expenditure. Whether or not this marketing is necessary, I'm not sure that this was a particularly, if it is, let's assume that you're absolutely correct. I'm not sure that it's a particularly effective marketing tool for the people who are actually going to be riding, except for, you know, other than the sort of highfalutin folks who are actually invited to these types of parties. I didn't get an invite.
The entire public was invited to the opening. So, and I got an invite in the mail.
Jonathan,
as a member of the public.
What about the bigger question? A lot of money being spent to publicize it and talk about it. How do we know it's being well spent?
Well, we know that what they've delivered so far in their revised timeline and their revised budget has worked. In terms of,
so you agree with Erica?
No, because actually, what this project with this phase that was supposed to open right now was at least supposed to go to the UW district. And I think it might have supposed to go up to Northgate, but they revised that back in 2006 or so. I think they found a giant boulder underneath. If I remember correctly, they found a giant boulder underneath the ship canal, and that totally screwed up their timeline for this project. So this link was on time and on budget, but if you look at the entire history of Sound Transit, they've had serious problems with hitting budget and hitting timeline. Now, that's not to say that there is not real value in adding Sound Transit and a light rail service through the neighborhood and over to the east side, but this is the problem that Sound Transit's going to have in the fall. That's asking for historic investment in light rail service. And when, you know, Erica can argue over this is whether this was a party or not, but blowing $850,000 on a one-day opening event.
We don't have to argue. Ask your reporter, Mike Lindblom, if he thinks it was blowing, you know, almost $1 million on a party.
Well, as Prince said, life is a party and parties aren't meant to last. So we're going to move along now. Bill Radke's away. I'm Ross Reynolds, KOW Executive Producer for Community Engagement. Erica C. Barnett is with us. Jonathan Martin and Jassy Ross. We're talking about the Week in Review. It's the Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. Bon Huberman has been monitoring your tweets at hashtag KUOWWIR. And someone had something interesting to tweet about the party.
Joe tweets, yes, it was a good party. I came from Skagit to celebrate you, Link, and I wouldn't have taken out Airbnb or bought Dick's Fries without it.
There you go, an economic boon from the party. We're going to change to something a bit more serious now. The Jungle is the name given to the large informal homeless camp under Interstate 5 south of downtown Seattle. It's been a scene of violence. Two people were killed and three wounded on January 26th when at least two people opened fire on a group gathered near a campfire. What to do about this? Fence it off, improve services to residents. Well, the mayor's office is going to announce a new approach to the Jungle soon. Seattle City Councilmember Sally Bagshaw has three ideas.
We need to have space, 24/7 space, where people can go. If we think we're going to go up and clean that out, we've got to have places to be able to offer for people to go. Second is we need to have more mental health beds because a lot of the folks that are in there have mental health issues. And lastly, we definitely need to have more treatment for drug addiction because the stuff that's driving people crazy is the garbage that we are seeing on the streets that are left behind, the needles that are left behind, and the cycle that folks who are in addiction get themselves into. And that treatment facility is probably the thing that we are lacking right now the most that could really make a difference for the safety of the rest of our city as well.
Jassy Ross, what do you think needs to be done with the Jungle? And let's acknowledge that calling it the Jungle is a little weird. It's kind of a weird name to use for this place where people are living, but it is an intractable problem. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I actually think the terminology is pretty important, and it shows, I think, sort of our the superioristic attitude that somehow this is a, you know, place where we can just kind of hide from and be away from it. You know, it's something that's invisibilized. And I appreciate the councilwoman, Sally Bagshaw, you know, making these suggestions, because I think in the short term, you know, we can all idealize certain remedies that are bigger. Well, we need housing for everybody, and we you know, nothing short of that is going to be sufficient, et cetera, et cetera. But
we can triage, right? We can walk and chew gum at the same time. And providing services is the first step in that triage. I think absolutely the chemical dependency counseling. I think that mental health counseling, mental health services is something that, you know, as a matter of empirical data is incredibly, it's profoundly missing amongst our homeless population. And we have to pay attention to these services that we're not providing. So I think she's on the right, on the right path.
Absolutely. And to that last point, Erica, you recently reported there may be some help when it comes to mental health services.
Well, actually, the thing that I wrote about was about drug treatment services.
Well, drug treatment is also a big,
which is tied in, and it is also a way into mental health services often. And it's a small thing. The there was a detox facility called Recovery Centers of King County. It shut down. There are, you know, allegations of financial improprieties and so forth. And so that facility is going to reopen under new ownership, Valley Cities. And I wrote about it at thecsforcrank.com. And it's going to have, you know, 16 beds at first. It will probably expand. We'll also have Suboxone treatment, most likely, which is treatment for opioid and heroin addiction. So it's just such a drop in the bucket. And the thing about Sally Bagshaw, about her proposals, they're great, but, you know, treatment bed funding comes from the state and federal governments. Yeah. Same thing with mental health services and mental health beds. And it's just such a complicated, huge issue. And, you know, when you see that how long it takes just to get detox facilities, and that's just the very first stopping point for most people into that system.
You know, Jossie, you mentioned triage, and I think that's a really important point. We can probably remember when in Seattle, even organized tent cities with rules and regulations were condemned as being dangerous and not enough, and a kind of admission of failure that with the issue of homelessness. Well, now organized tent cities are being sanctioned by the city as a necessity because the long-term solution's out there. And now we're looking at this place called The Jungle, an informal tent city without the kind of oversight you'd see in a place like Nicholsville. Should the city figure out a way to support these informal, unsupervised spaces like The Jungle, Jonathan?
No. In a word, no. I don't want to say I've written extensively about the mental health system. We could spend an hour just on talking about where that system is failing right now. But the reason why I think that The Jungle, you know, go to Javasi's point about this sort of being out of sight and out of mind, and your point about what we've said is a downward cycle of the floor of allowable living situations. We didn't use the tent cities used to be guerrilla tent camps. And we're not sanctioned by the city. And then we decided in the crisis, we're going to sanction those. And now we're talking about effectively sanctioning The Jungle. And I just have to say, what point are we going to say as a city, say, this is just not what we're going to accept?
But if you don't sanction it, what do? Fence it off and kick all those people out? And where do they go? And how does that solve the problem or get at solving the problem?
Well, I think that we can get caught up in solving the larger problem, like Erica mentioned, the fact that mental health and chemical dependency systems are funded at the state and federal level primarily. And so, well, we can't get those right, so then we have to do this and this and this. I think that you really need to set an allowable standard of what we're going to say is okay. And if you you're not ever going to kick everybody out of The Jungle. It's a huge space. It's very densely forested, but you can certainly put gates up around the driveways. You can patrol it. You can say, and we can also say, if somebody is in there, then this is not okay.
Well, Erica, do we need to set a base level, as Jonathan says? And if we do, is the place called The Jungle below that?
Well, I mean, I think it's below the level that any of us would want to be living. Yeah. We have to look at why people choose to live there and actually talk to them and ask them why. And, you know, and when we say things like, we just have to get them out of there. I mean, I see that a lot in neighborhood discussions as well. They just need to not be there. They're living at a standard that is unacceptable to me. The question is, okay, so what do? You build a wall around The Jungle, you kick everybody out, and then what, do you put them in jail? I mean, because to me, nobody ever wants to answer that question of what is the sanction? And it seems like the only sanction is forced treatment, which we can't afford and which doesn't work, or jail.
Actually, the state law just passed forced treatment for mental health patients. No, for chemical dependency as well.
It's a very small number, but I want to give Jossie a chance to weigh in here before we finish up.
I agree with Erica, and I think that the point is well taken, that this just becomes a distributional question, that whether we have the evil that we don't know, which is distribution into every place. That means we need to have a bunch of people who need services, who admittedly need a lot of services in a lot of different places, or we have a discrete area where we can actually provide services. It seems like that might be a slightly more economical and humane way of dealing with things. Now, as a point of fact, a good 70%, I'm making up numbers a little bit, I'm fudging a little bit, but 70% of folks within the correctional facilities at any given time also have mental health issues. And so, no, they do get arrested for being mentally ill. Now, does that mean that if you're acting crazy, you're going to get arrested? A lot of times, yes. But it also means people in manic states are going to go do things in vulnerability off their meds that they might not otherwise do in places that we're not expecting it and not a discrete little area.
Jesse Ross, Erica C. Barnett, Jonathan Martin with us. It's the Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds. Stick around. Bill Radke's away. I'm Ross Reynolds, KUOW Executive Producer for Community Engagement. We're chewing over the stories in the news this week with Erica C. Barnett at C for Crank, Jonathan Martin, editorialist for the Seattle Times, Jesse Ross, a local attorney. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has shut down plans for a coal export terminal near Cherry Point, Washington. The Corps upheld an appeal by the Lummi tribe to block the building of the Deepwater Terminal. It was the reaction from the Lummi tribe.
I want you to know that we've made a decision on the correct, which was a denial without prejudice.
Well, some people are not cheering. While the Lummi tribe was happy about this, there was a tribe in the Powder River Basin where the coal is being exported from, not happy because of job loss. And indeed, some people here in Washington State thought this coal export terminal would have provided much-needed jobs. Is this a victory or a loss for Washington State? Jossie, what do you think?
Well, first of all, Ross, I want to acknowledge that, yeah, unquestionably, this is a victory for Washington State. This is a victory for Washington State in 2100, in 2200, in the future for our children, grandchildren. And we all owe a debt of gratitude to the Lummi tribe, to Chairman Timothy Ballew, and all the folks who championed taking this very, very strong position and saying we're not going to take this blood money that will slowly further generations with dirty coal. Now, it's interesting, and I spoke with you briefly about this, that, you know, it's an interesting juxtaposition with a different conversation that's going on right now, whereas the Lummi tribe is being lauded by environmentalists, largely white environmentalists, who say this was a horrible thing, and the Lummi tribe had standing, whereas they didn't have standing to bring suit. Those same environmentalists are not getting involved in a different conversation that's going on involving fish. That is, the reason why this decision came down from the Army Corps of Engineers was because the Lummi tribe relied upon their traditional right to fish under the Treaty of 1855. Well, there's a group of fishermen, tribal fishermen, who say we want to fish for ceremonial fishing or whatever reasons. And those particular fishermen are getting death threats. They're getting this horrible, horrible racist vitriol from sports fishermen. And that same treaty right that allowed this Lummi tribe to defeat the army, or excuse me, this coal port, this proposed coal port, is the reason why that Native people in large are being grouped together and saying, you shouldn't be allowed to do this. We need to abrogate treaties. And this is, you know, a lot of other racist
vision. And I hear you saying environmentalists aren't sticking up for them.
Not at all.
No,
they're not. They're turning a blind eye to this where, you know, and it seems to me if this treaty fishing right is the reason, the basis for this victory, and it's something that we've done in common as a matter of historical record since time immemorial, 20,000 years, whatever, that they should likewise understand the necessity for tribes to do it in large and stick up when those white fishermen, sports fishermen are, you know, chanting this racist vitriol.
Yeah, Erica, what do you think about this decision based on the Lummi tribe appeal? Is this good for Washington State, a loss for Washington State?
I think it's good for Washington State because, first of all, the number of jobs that were going to be produced by any of these coal terminals, and a lot of them have been rejected now. I believe the only one that's still up for permit is in Longview.
Yeah.
And that one, the projection is 20 net new jobs. So, I mean, we're not talking about a lot of jobs here. What we are talking about is transitioning our economy from a coal economy, which is a dying economy, to an economy based on, you know, on green energy and on other sources of revenue. And so I think it's a win for communities because we're not going to have, you know, mile and 2 mile long coal trains going through, polluting our communities, you know, coal dust in the air. And so for places like Seattle and Tacoma and Bellingham, I think this is great news just for the communities that were going to be impacted by these trains.
Well, it's certainly, if you believe the objections that the coal dust will be in the air here, it's certainly good for those communities that won't have to experience that. But the bigger question is exporting this coal to China, having it be burned and causing a future climate apocalypse. If we're not going to build it there, if we don't build it in Longview, isn't it going to be built somewhere? And isn't this coal going to go somewhere anyway and still get burned? I'm just wondering if this is a Pyrrhic victory. What do you think, Jonathan?
I think it might be a Pyrrhic victory, but I think it was a good one. I think that the cities and towns had a legitimate interest in not seeing these trains roll through. And frankly, they didn't have the power to stop them because federal railway law treats railroads like their own nation, which is ironic that they ran into a real nation, independent nation. You know, I think in terms of the big picture, coal right now is the use of coal globally declined for the first time in a long time, I think in history, I believe, last year. China's air pollution problem has gotten so severe that they're having companies run out of there because they can't get workers to go, executives to go there. But this once again feels like a proxy fight to me. What the real issue here is a national carbon tax. Mm-hmm. You really have to price this stuff because coal is the worst polluter of the dirtiest source of fuel. And until we actually address the larger problem, this is just going to be these proxy wars.
This issue of climate change is kind of in the back of our minds almost all the time if you're a thinking person in this world about what's going to happen. I'd like to kind of ask you the big question. If you're thinking about it right now, Jonathan, are we going to deal with it or are our days numbered?
That's a big question.
Yeah, that's a very big question.
How are you feeling about it right now? Are you feeling optimistic, pessimistic?
No, I'm feeling very pessimistic.
Yeah.
I'm feeling very pessimistic. I think that there is both the that we have seen with a presidential candidate like Donald Trump, a unwillingness to embrace reason. And I think that science is part of the fundamental, should be a fundamental backbone of our civic discourse. And right now, science feels like it's getting sent to the back row.
Erica, optimistic, pessimistic?
I'm extremely pessimistic, mm-hmm. but I'm optimistic about one thing, which is the possibility that we'll get a president who actually believes in science and believes that climate change is real and is caused by human activity. And that might, you know, who knows, maybe start to turn things around. But from all the science...
It's probably not a Congress, though.
But probably not a Congress. And all the science that we're seeing now is saying that, you know, we really need to keep the global climate change down to 1.5 degrees. And not 2 degrees. So it's just, that's not the direction we're heading in at all.
Jesse, what do you think?
Well, the reason why I could be optimistic, and I'm going to, you know, just contrast a little bit with my friend Jonathan Martin regarding the term Pyrrhic victory, because I think it actually can be a change. That is that this didn't have to go through Congress, nor did it have to go through a president. It was a rule of law victory. It was a victory that recognized it, although about 160 years too late, these treaties with sovereign nations, native people. Environmentalist David Suzuki said that, well, we need to look not toward white environmentalists, but toward indigenous people's historic traditional use of the land. And so if that use of the land, as you know, documented by Uncle Billy Frank and the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, if we actually deferred to that for some period of time, indigenous people around the world, I think that there's absolutely a reason to be optimistic. And this could be, I'm not saying it is, but it could be the sign of an era of recognizing both the veracity of those treaties and that treatment of the earth, as well as the knowledge and wisdom that these indigenous people have.
Good. I'm glad we ended with you on this point because I feel better about it. After this is the Week in Review. You've got thoughts, tweet us at hashtag KUOWWIR. Jossie Ross is with us, Erica C. Barnett, and Jonathan Martin. This is KUOW. Up ahead, Trump in Washington. Bill Radke is away. It's Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds, the executive producer for community engagement here at KUOW. And we're talking about the Week in Review with Erica C. Barnett at C is for Crank, Jonathan Martin. You can read him at the Seattle Times, and Jossie Ross, a local lawyer. we can weigh in also. Tweet to us at KUOWWIR, hashtag KUOWWIR. Well, in case you missed it, Donald J. Trump made a swing through the Northwest last weekend, stopping in Spokane and Linden. Most of what he had to say was a standard stump speech, but he did speak for a couple of minutes in Linden about Washington State.
Look at this. Number of timber and construction jobs has declined 20% in Linden region since 2006. That's not very 20%. Come on, folks. What the hell is wrong with you? The truth is, it's your leadership at the top. The trade deals are a disaster. We're not going to do it. We're not going to take this. We're going to negotiate trade deals. They're going to be so good and they're going to be so smart. Nearly 1 in 7 manufacturing jobs in the state of Washington has been lost. NAFTA, listen to this, NAFTA has been one of the great economic disasters. We can win, Washington State. We're going to win.
So according to Trump, trade deals are killing jobs in Washington State, 1 in 7 manufacturing jobs. Thousands of timber jobs in the Northwest are going away in the Northwest part of our state. My question for you, first of all, is do you think that message has a broad appeal in Washington State? What do you think, Jonathan?
Well, certainly the populist message in that there is some appeal to that. The problem is, like, what Trump says, it's complete hookum. He's the most lying candidate I think we've ever had at the national office before, and for national office. You know, the fact is that you're looking at the manufacturing jobs that were lost. I think you also have to look at the manufacturing jobs that are here. 1 in 3 jobs in Washington State are tied to trade. It's the most trade-dependent state in the country. I wonder how many folks who are in that crowd in Linden would be losing their jobs if Donald Trump successfully starts a trade war. You know, you're talking about it, Jim McInerney, the former CEO of Boeing this week, pointed out the last time we got in a serious trade war was, and that was right before the Great Recession. This is it's just sort of like this candy packaging. It sounds great, but Trump is economic nihilism for Washington.
Erica, what do you think? Do you think this anti-trade message, after all, we're the place where in 1999 thousands of people filled the street kind of protesting trade going on. Do you think this message is going to appeal to folks in Washington State? Are they feeling beat down by NAFTA and trade agreements?
Well, I think that, first of all, the manufacturing jobs that we've lost, let's look at what those jobs are. Boeing decided to leave. So that's a huge chunk of that Trump doesn't mention. So that's not because of free trade with Mexico, or Canada. NAFTA, I remember all that. I was opposed to NAFTA too. I hesitate to.
Oh, you agree with Donald Trump about
exactly,
that.
Exactly. That's why I hesitate to even say that. But like Jonathan said, he's a liar. And I don't know how broadly, that message about trade is going to appeal. I will say that in Eastern Washington and in Central Washington, NAFTA has probably been good for the state because it's allowed more immigration and people and farm workers to come into Washington State who are willing to work for lower pay. And so it's actually benefited farmers. So, I mean, I don't know how much the idea that NAFTA is terrible and that we need to start a trade war is going to appeal to those farmers.
Can I also point out that the timber issue that Trump was talking about there, the problem with the timber industry is much more tied to environmental regulations than it is to trade. You know, you do have some competition from Canadian timber, but it's not the reason the loss of jobs, again, Trump packages this populist stuff in this candy coating, but it's just wrong.
Jesse, Trump says a lot of things. He had these things to say about Washington State, about how trade is bad, we're losing jobs because of it, it's hurting timber jobs. Do you think that message has any appeal here?
Yeah, I definitely think it has appeal. I mean, you know, the truth is, if you have lost a job, you're not necessarily looking for the scientific proximate causation of what that job loss was. You want somebody to blame. And if you find a convenient, shell for that particular, blame, then I think it absolutely will have appeal. And I find myself, like Erica, also saying, oh, I completely disagreed with NAFTA. I hated NAFTA. I was one of the people that got tear gas in the streets. And, I look at, some of the trade agreements since then. What is it? The gold standard of trade agreements, the Trans-Pacific. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think those are going to be horrible in the large scheme of things. I think absolutely, as Jonathan said, for the
quick for the quick win, I think that it's something that will benefit Washington State. But I think in the long term, I think it does end up with Washington State and the United States getting hosed.
But is Trump a credible messenger?
Of course not. He's not a credible messenger for too much other than hairspray. But he does happen to stumble upon some cool stuff every once in a while. And I find myself begrudgingly agreeing with the man, like, oh, OK,
well, don't worry. He'll change his position tomorrow.
I know.
I gotta say, the one thing that surprised me about his appearances in the Northwest is that they went ahead fairly peacefully. We're in a city where protesters took the mic from Bernie Sanders last summer.
Right.
Donald Trump, admittedly, he wasn't in Seattle, but he comes to Eugene, he comes to Spokane, he comes to Linden, and they're pretty much uneventful. Were you surprised that there wasn't more of a pushback against his presence here, any of you?
Well, we're really nice here. and he didn't come to Seattle.
Yeah.
Linden's
a
long way away.
I also think that Trump is trying to be more presidential right now, and the earlier sort of the baiting of the crowds that he did that really provoked violence was... I'm assuming his team is smart enough to realize if he has any shot of appealing to broad class voters, you know, he's got to stop acting like he's a thug.
And he probably is like any particular large scale rapper and has his security detailed the size of, you know, the Canadian Army. I'm sure he's very, very well armed at these things.
Well, we always underestimate Donald Trump. What about his final assertion in that little snippet we heard? Can Donald Trump win Washington State in November? Do any of you think that he can?
You look at the voting history of Washington State, and this is where Washington gets the reputation as a blue state. I mean, it likes at the state and federal level, it generally likes moderate Democrats. And Hillary Clinton actually seems to be kind of tailor-made for the state. If I had actually put money down on all my bets about Trump so far, I'd be broke.
Yeah.
So he makes a fool out of every prognosticator.
Do the other two of you hesitate to say he cannot win Washington State because of the fact we've been wrong so often?
I don't hesitate.
Okay.
I wouldn't hesitate to say that
right.
either.
Be it resolved. We're going to be right back with more on Week in Review. Erica C. Barnett, Jonathan Martin, and Jossie Ross. It's KUOW Seattle. Bill Racky's away. I'm Ross Reynolds, KUOW Executive Producer for Community Engagement, and this is the Week in Review with Jossie Ross, Jonathan Martin, and Erica C. Barnett. This week, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof wrote a column titled, A Confession of Liberal Intolerance. He begins, quote, "We progressives believe in diversity and we want women, blacks, Latinos, gays, and Muslims at the table as long as they are not conservatives. We're fine with people who don't look like us, as long as they think like us," end quote. Jossie Ross, is there such a thing as liberal intolerance? And if so, what do you think it is?
Oh, hell yeah. I mean, I've graduated from Evergreen State College. And, you know, the only thing that was off, off limits at Evergreen State College is everything that's not liberal, right? And, you know, that's largely the case amongst most liberals. Now, I fall into that as well. You know, I think most of us do. And there's just logical extremes where, okay, yeah, I want to tolerate this, but you're promoting intolerance. So I can't tolerate your intolerance. At some point, it gets kind of stupid, you know, to just consistently.
I think we mean illegitimate liberal intolerance.
No, I understand.
Yeah.
But I mean, but there is a place where I think we have to, you know, be honest with ourselves that just these definitions are kind of, they're vapid. So liberal, conservative, they don't necessarily capture, no, I'm not a liberal. I'm for humanity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm for humanity. And if you're promoting something that's against humanity, I don't like you. And that's irrespective of what ethnicity, what, you know, political denomination you come from. And I think that our political definitions need to get a little bit more acute and precise.
What do you think about this, Erica? Is there such a thing as liberal intolerance? And if you've spent a lot of time in political circles here in Seattle and in Washington State, do you ever hear someone say something and get jumped on and say to yourself, that's not very tolerant of that conservative person or that conservative perspective?
I think the real question, is there ever a good Nicholas Kristof column? And the answer is no.
All right, you're changing the subject.
No, I mean, I think this is an absurd. I mean, this column is absurd. Of course, anyone can be intolerant of other people and their views, but the idea that, you know, that somehow liberals are crowding out conservative voices in a nation that is, you know, largely Christian, a very conservative nation overall. I mean, I think a lot of times the people who are in power feel as though they're being shouted down when they have to listen to the voices of people who are not in power at all. And I think, you know, like there's this hand-wringing in conservative circles and I guess in Nicholas Kristof's house about, you know, about colleges, and they're so intolerant of conservative views. I would counter that by saying, you know, having a safe space or asking for a safe space to be heard, you know, for people who have never really been heard, you know, and people who, you know, when I was in college, you know, the classes that I took, you know, I learned about white philosophy, I learned about white history, even at a liberal arts school. And, you know, and that was only 20 years ago and 15 years ago, 20 years ago. And things have changed a lot since then. I'm dating myself. I'm like, wait a minute, I'm not that old. But, you know, and things have changed, I think, in a good way in that, you know, other voices are being heard. And so, you know, the Nicholas Kristofs of the world, you know, sort of get a little agitated when they're asked to listen and not just speak all the time.
Well, Kristof quotes George Yancey, who's a sociologist. He's black and he's evangelical. And he tells him, outside of academia, I faced more problems as a black. Inside academia, I faced more problems as a Christian. He said it's not even close, end quote. What do you think about this idea that there's liberal intolerance, Jonathan?
Well, I think we have to talk about within academia and without academia. I think that college campuses are particular places, and there's definitely a rise of PCism on campus that I think if you read Jonathan Chait's piece in the New York Magazine last year, that was fascinating, had a fascinating anecdote about a Muslim columnist for the student paper that wrote a kind of a mocking, kind of a joke column about PCism, and he ended up being subject to basically kind of a hate crime. Like, he had people like graffiti on his doorstep, and he ended up getting fired from the student newspaper. It was fascinating. But I think the larger issue, but I actually do think that liberals are just capable of just as much intolerance as conservatives are. I think that it's a little bit harder sometimes for liberals to believe that because there's a, I don't know. But what we have right now is a self-sorting that's going on in America, and particularly Seattle. I think if most people who are listening to this would ask how many people they know that have ever voted for a Republican or, you know, maybe even voted against a tax increase, I bet it's a relatively small number. So the self-sorting that happens also goes to our media consumption habits. We tend to consume media that agrees with us. And all of this is very, very concerning to me. I think this is one of the fundamental challenges we have as a society right now, and it's one of the reasons why Donald Trump is a major party candidate.
Well, more to talk about with that in the future, no doubt about it. I got one final question for our panelists on Week in Review, and that's, what's the news story or just the news in your life that you're going to be talking about with friends this weekend? Jonathan Martin, I know for you it's a comment made by Hillary Clinton.
I would like us to go into those files and hopefully make as much of that public as possible. If there's nothing there, let's tell people there's nothing there.
What if there is something there?
Well, if there is something there, unless it's a, you know, threat to national security, I think we ought to share it with the public.
Jonathan Martin, what is Hillary referring to, and why are you going to be talking about that this weekend?
UFOs.
What?
Yeah. She wants to open up the Area 51 files. She actually seems a genuine believer on this issue. John Podesta, her campaign chairman, has talked basically unabashedly about the government hiding information about aliens. And Hillary, Bill actually, when he was president, opened up the Roswell files. And if you need no other bona fides, Chris Carter is donated to her campaign, the X-Files creator.
Wow. Do we know Donald's position on opening up these files? Good soundbite. Erica, what about you? What are you going to be talking about this weekend, either in the news or your news?
Yeah, I am really interested to see the Samantha Bee show next week. And I will admit, I am an internet person. I don't know when the show comes on television. But anyway, they were at City Hall yesterday talking to the female city council members who were subjected to a barrage of misogynistic comments and threats over their arena vote. And so she's going to be delving into that. So I'm really interested to see what kind of comments they got and who she talks to on the other side and what they have to say.
I can't think of anyone better to analyze that one. How about you, Jossie Ross? What's the news you're going to be thinking about this weekend?
Two things. Number one, it's my big brother Brian Cladisby's birthday. And so I'm thinking
Happy birthday, Brian.
I'm thinking about fishing. You know, he's a fisherman and fishing up in Swinomish and that interaction between tribal fishermen and sport fishermen. Number two is Bernie Sanders was on Pine Ridge Reservation yesterday. And Bernie started off, and I think that there was a level of optics and just, you know, well, we're trying to get a particular constituency's vote. And when he was hanging out with Native people, Bernie's been saying hanging out with a lot of Native people recently. Like, Bernie might get adopted pretty soon. You ever watch Thunderheart? Val Kilmer? I think Bernie might be relocating, going to a few ceremonies pretty soon. I think he's getting in touch with a spiritual part of himself that he's never seen before. So, oy vey, Bernie. Come on.
Jossie Ross, he's a local lawyer. Jonathan Martin, editorialist at the Seattle Times, and Erica Barnett. You can read her at C is for Crank. Thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Ross.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amin Al-Sadi is our producer. Jeannie Yendel is our editor. Bernard Ouellette is our esteemed engineer. I'm Ross Reynolds, KUOW's executive producer for community engagement. Bill Radke is back next week with The Week in Review.